Numbers, chapters 3 and 4. The second talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on August 19, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 2, numbers 3 and 4, accompanies this talk.
We'll be back in the book of Numbers. Chapters 3 and 4 is what I have set out for us. And the outline is long, but I'm going to try to make it through the whole outline. And if I don't, I'll have to make some kind of mid-course correction. Last week, we saw how the Israelites took a census, and the census was for the purpose of figuring out how many fighting men that were in their midst. It was an exercise to prepare them to engage in warfare when that is necessary. And the passage explained how the people of Israel would be arranged in their camps when they stopped, and then the order in which they would march out when they were underway. And notice that before Sinai, they had been marching from Egypt to Sinai, and there's no indication of what their organization was. And yet now, with the construction of the tabernacle, and now that God is in their midst, everything is organized around that tabernacle. Everything is organized with respect to God, is arrayed around that. This week, we're going to have two more censuses. This time, it's going to be censuses of the Levites for two different reasons. And so we'll look at that. And on the way, there's going to be an allusion to an event that is described in Leviticus 10. And that's what I really want to get to. But I'm going to save that to the last, so we'll... We'll see if we make it. Okay, chapter 3, the first section, verses 1 through 4. Now these are the records of the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time when the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. These then are the names of the sons of Aaron: Nadab the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priests, whom he ordained to serve as priests. But Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered strange fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. So Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime of their father Aaron. So this is genealogical information with respect to Aaron and Moses, because this is a record of the priests. So it's going to be talking about priests and Levites in the next two chapters. Interestingly, it says Aaron and Moses, Aaron being first in this particular context, which is very unusual. It's usually Moses and Aaron, with Moses coming first. And of all the times that the Old Testament, well, I shouldn't say the Old Testament, in all the times that the Pentateuch talks about Moses and Aaron, it is, and there are about 70 some of them, it's always Moses first, except in contexts where it's talking about genealogy. So that's the reason why Aaron is first here, is this is a genealogical, it's genealogical information that we're being given. It goes on to list the names of the sons of Aaron. There are four of them, and those are all listed in chronological order. That Nadab was the first, Abihu second, etc. Notice that the sons of Moses are not mentioned here at all, and that's a curious omission. I'm not sure why that is. Then it says that Nadab and Abihu, so the two oldest sons of Aaron, they died before the Lord when they offered strange fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai. That's the incident that I want to talk about in Leviticus 10. I looked at that and found it very intriguing. And there are some things that come out of that passage that will be significant for the next couple of weeks. And I do want to get to that. Nadab and Abihu had no children, so there are no, there's no one to carry on those lines. And I suspect that that's interesting because it is the descent of high-ranking priests that can cause schisms later on. And we can talk about that at another time, but there will be no schisms that will develop out of the two oldest sons of Aaron. And it points out that Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime or in the presence of their father Aaron. So I think the importance here is that there's a great deal of continuity between Aaron and the sons that survived. They learned everything from him. The next section. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Bring the tribe of Levi near and set them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. And they shall perform the duties for him and for the whole congregation before the tent of meeting to do the service of the tabernacle. They shall also keep all the furnishings of the tent of meeting, along with the duties of the sons of Israel, to do the service of the tabernacle. You shall thus give the Levites to Aaron and to his sons. They are wholly given to him from among the sons of Israel. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, that they may keep their priesthood. But the layman who comes near shall be put to death." So God is saying, bring the tribe of Levi near, set them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. So the relationship between the Levites and the priests is being established here. The priests are the ones who serve in the tabernacle and do the actual religious ritual of the tabernacle. The Levites are the ones that assist that in various ways. And the Levites, then, their job is to serve the priests in any way that the priests need to be served. Serve them in performing their duties. Serve them as they serve the whole congregation. And to do the service of the tabernacle. It's also their job to keep the furnishings of the tabernacle. It doesn't point it out here yet, but it will come up later. They will transport the tabernacle. They will also have the responsibility of guarding the tabernacle. And then in verse 10 it says, So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons that they may keep their priesthood, but the layman who comes near shall be put to death. So the priests are the ones who do the actual service in the tabernacle. So we've got two groups of people that have access to the tabernacle: the priests who carry out the religious ritual in the tabernacle, and the Levites who assist that in various ways. Then it says, but the layman who comes near shall be put to death. No one else is authorized to come to the, into the tabernacle, except on certain occasions. There are lay people that can come to the tabernacle and even come into the tabernacle, into the outer courtyard. But anyone who comes without authorization shall be put to death. And the my translation has layman, but a better translation would be any encroacher. Anyone who encroaches on the tabernacle shall be put to death. Any unauthorized person who comes to the tabernacle shall be put to death. That phrase is repeated three times. This is the second time. The first time was in chapter 1, verse 51, and it will be repeated again in chapter, I don't see it right now, but it's coming up. So that is very important, and I think that, and it's always in the context of talking about the priests. So the point is, the priests and the Levites have access to the tabernacle. No one else is authorized. And if anyone approaches who is not authorized, they shall be put to death. Next section. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Now behold, I have taken the Levites from among the sons of Israel, instead of every firstborn, the first issue of the womb among the sons of Israel. So the Levites shall be mine, for all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified to myself all the firstborn of Israel, from man to beast. They shall be mine. I am the Lord." If you remember back to in Exodus, after the angel of death was sent through to kill all of the firstborn in Egypt, both of man and animals, after that happened, God said, the firstborn are mine. The firstborn belong to me. And so he's repeating that here, that God has claim, God has legitimate claim to all the firstborn. But what he's going to do is he is going to take Levites in exchange for the firstborn. So the Levites are going to be set aside for service of God. They'll be the ones that play that role instead of the firstborn, even though God has a right to all the firstborn. So that's going to be the reason for the first census, is to find out how many Levites there are. Next section. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, saying, "Number the sons of Levi by their fathers' households, by their families. Every male from a month old and upward you shall number." So Moses numbered them according to the word of God, just as he had been commanded. These then are the sons of Levi by their names, Gershon and Kohath and Merari. And these are the names of the sons of Gershon by their families, Libni and Shimei. And the sons of Kohath by their families, Amram and Izhar, Hebron and Uziel. And the sons of Merari by their families, Mali and Mushi. These are the families of the Levites according to their fathers' households. So a census is supposed to be taken of all of the sons of Levi by family and by household. And they're supposed to count all of the males that are 1 month old and older. And apparently at 1 month of age, a child could be redeemed. So it's at 1 month of age, official action can be taken with respect to a child. And the main family groups in the tribe of Levi are these three: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And those are listed in chronological order, oldest to youngest. Okay. Next section. Of Gershon was the family of the Libnites and the family of the Shimeites. These were the families of the Gershonites. Their numbered men in the numbering of every male from a month old and upward, even their numbered men were 7,500. The families of the Gershonites were to camp behind the tabernacle westward. And the leader of the father's household of the Gershonites was Eliasaph, the son of Lael. Now the duties of the sons of Gershon in the tent of meeting involved the tabernacle and the tent, its covering and the screen for the doorway of the tent of meeting, and the hangings of the court and the screen for the doorway of the court, which is around the tabernacle and the altar and its cords, according to all the service concerning them. So we have two things happening here. One is a numbering of the first family that's going to be numbered, the first of the families of Levi, Gershon. It gives the number, then it tells where they are to camp, and then it'll talk about their duties. As you'll recall from last week, then, if we've got our camp up here, and I'm sure you can all see it well, we've got the tabernacle in the middle. The pride of place goes to those who are camped to the east, as you will recall. Second is south, third is west, and fourth is the north. The Levites are going to be similarly arrayed around the tabernacle. They're just on an inner circle around that tabernacle. And Gershon is westward. So that's the number three spot. East is one, south is two, west is the number three spot. And their duties are to carry and set up all of the tent and curtain materials that make up the tabernacle. So that means that all of the cloth that creates the outer courtyard, the cloths that hang all around the outside of the courtyard, they will carry those. They will also carry the tent materials for the tabernacle itself, including the screen of the doorway for the tent of meeting. So that's the door that is the entrance into the tent. The hangings of the court, and the screen for the doorway of the court. So that's the doorway that is part of that outer screen around the whole court. Okay. So that's Gershon. Kohath, verse 27. And of Kohath was the family of the Amramites, and the family of the Izharites, and the family of the Hebronites, and the family of the Uzielites. These were the families of the Kohathites. In the numbering of every male, from a month old and upward, there were 8,000 performing the duties of the sanctuary. The families of the sons of Kohath were to camp on the southward side of the tabernacle, and the leader of the father's households of the Kohathite families was Elizaphan, the son of Uziel. Now their duties involved the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, and the utensils of the sanctuary with which they minister, and the screen, and all the service concerning them. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, was the chief of the leaders of Levi and had oversight of those who performed the duties of the sanctuary. So the members of Kohath are all numbered, counted, and there are 8,600 of them. And their responsibilities have to do with the furniture inside the tabernacle. And it'll talk more about that later. It'll talk about it in greater detail later on. They are to camp on the southward side. So that's the number two spot. And over them Eleazar is going to be their supervisor, Eleazar being the oldest of the sons of Aaron that are still living. The third family, then, of the Levites is the Merari family, the third and last. Verse 33, of Merari was the family of the Mahlites and the family of the Mushites. These were the families of Merari. Their numbered men and the numbering of every male from a month old and upward were 6,200. And the leader of the father's households of the families of Merari was Zuriel, the son of Abihail. They were to camp on the northward side of the tabernacle. Now the appointed duties of the sons of Merari involved the frames of the tabernacle, its bars, its pillars, its sockets, all its equipment, and the service concerning them, and the pillars around the court with their sockets and their pegs and their cords. So this family is going to camp on the northward side. So that's the fourth position. And they are the ones who are supposed to carry all the stuff that holds up the tent and that holds up the curtain that goes out around the entire courtyard. So they've got all the heavy lifting and all the all the supports. Verse 38. Now those who were to camp before the tabernacle eastward, before the tent of meeting toward the sunrise, are Moses and Aaron and his sons, performing the duties of the sanctuary for the obligation of the sons of Israel. But the layman coming near was to be put to death. All the numbered men of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered at the command of the Lord by their families, every male from a month old and upward, were 22,000. So the fourth group is the priests. This is the descendants of Aaron, but also it's Moses and his sons are there also. We just never get them listed specifically. So they're the ones that camp to the east, and that's the privileged position. There wouldn't be many of them. We've just got Aaron and he has two sons left. Moses, and I can't remember how many Moses had. So it's not a lot of people that would be camped in that east position. And they are from the family of Kohath. There are no numbers given for these priests, but they are part of the family of Kohath. I assume that their numbers are incorporated into that number. It gives the total of 22,000. That is, if you add up the numbers, that is not the total. The total is a little more than that, a couple hundred more than that. And by the way, the Septuagint has another total, which also does not match the total of the three numbers. So it does seem to me that the numbers have some problems. And notice here we have that same phrase that I pointed out occurs three times. I couldn't find the third time, but here it is. But the layman, or the one who encroaches, was to be put to death. So it's making it really clear that the priests and the Levites have a privileged access to the tabernacle, and other people do not have that same access. Verse 40, then the Lord said to Moses, number every firstborn male of the sons of Israel from a month old and upward, and make a list of their names. And you shall take the Levites for me, I am the Lord, instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the cattle of the sons of Israel. So Moses numbered all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded him, and all the firstborn males by the number of names from a month old and upward, for their numbered men were 22,273. So there were 22,000 Levites, according to verse 39. The number of the firstborn in Israel is 22,273. So there are more firstborn than there are Levites. Now we're going to resolve that problem in the next section, starting with verse 44. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites, and the Levites shall be mine. I am the Lord. And for the ransom of the 273 of the firstborn of the sons of Israel, who are in excess beyond the Levites, you shall take 5 shekels apiece per head. You shall take them in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerahs. And give the money, the ransom, of those who are in excess among them to Aaron and his sons." So Moses took the ransom money from those who were in excess beyond those ransomed by the Levites. From the firstborn of the sons of Israel, he took the money in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, 1,365. Then Moses gave the ransom money to Aaron and to his sons at the command of the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So what's happening is, with those 273 additional firstborn, they are going to be ransomed. That an amount of money will be paid for each of them, and that money will go to the priests, and that will take care of that obligation of the firstborn to be in service of God. The amount that has to be paid is 5 shekels per person. 5 shekels, as I understand it, would have been about 6 months' wages. So it's a pretty good amount of money per person. And that was the price at which one could buy a slave. A young slave was 5 shekels. As a slave grew to be a man, the price went up significantly. But as a child, it was 5 shekels. Okay. Chapter 4. Now we get to hear in greater detail the duties of each of the tribes of each of the families of the Levites. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "Take a census of the descendants of Kohath from among the sons of Levi, by their families, by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, all who enter the service to do the work of the tent, in the tent of meeting. This is the work of the descendants of Kohath in the tent of meeting, concerning the most holy things. When the camp sets out, Aaron and his sons shall go in, and they shall take down the veil of the screen and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. And they shall lay a covering of porpoise skin on it, and shall spread over it a cloth of pure blue, and shall insert its poles. Over the table of the bread of the presence, they shall also spread a cloth of blue, and put on it the dishes and the pans and the sacrificial bowls and the jars for the libation, and the continual bread shall be on it. And they shall spread over them a cloth of scarlet material, and cover the same with a covering of porpoise skin, and they shall insert its poles. Then they shall take a blue cloth and cover the lampstand for the light, along with its lamps and its snuffers and its trays and all the oil vessels by which they serve it. And they shall put it and all its utensils in a covering of porpoise skin, and shall put it on the carrying bars. And over the golden altar they shall spread a blue cloth and cover it with a covering of porpoise skin, and shall insert its poles. And they shall take all the utensils of service with which they serve in the sanctuary, and put them in a blue cloth, and cover them with a covering of porpoise skin, and put them on the carrying bars. Then they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread a purple cloth over it. They shall also put on it all its utensils by which they serve in connection with it, and the fire pans, the forks, and the shovels, and the basins, and all the utensils of the altar. And they shall spread a covering of porpoise skin over it and insert its poles. And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy objects and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is to set out, after that the sons of Kohath shall come and carry them, so that they may not touch the holy objects and die. These are the things in the tent of meeting which the sons of Kohath are to carry. And the responsibility of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, is the oil for the light and the fragrant incense and the continual grain offering and the anointing oil. The responsibility of all the tabernacle and of all that is in it with the sanctuary and its furnishings. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "Do not let the tribe of the families of the Kohathites be cut off from among the Levites, but do this to them that they may live and not die when they approach the most holy objects. Aaron and his sons shall go in and assign each of them to his work and to his load, but they shall not go in to see the holy objects even for a moment, lest they die." So this describes how the Kohathites are supposed to get things ready to transport them, and that's their responsibility. The priests will be the ones who actually cover each of the pieces of furniture. And they're covered a little bit differently. They're all covered with materials that apparently are used in the tabernacle itself, in the tent part of the tabernacle. But the Ark of the Covenant, it is first covered by taking down the veil that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. They take that down and they put that over the Ark of the Covenant. Then they put another cloth on, then they put the porpoise skins on it, and then they cover that with a blue cloth. And then it says they insert the poles. In Exodus, it had told us that the poles were never to be removed. So I don't know how to reconcile Exodus with what it says here. But here it's talking about putting those poles in to make it ready for them to be carried. So what you would see if you looked at the Ark of the Covenant after it's ready to go is just the blue cloth covering over the top of it. That's the only piece of furniture where you would just see the blue cloth. The others that it talks about are the table of the showbread. And that one, they put the blue cloth on it first. Then they put scarlet material over it. And then they put the porpoise skin. So there, the porpoise skin, which was red, by the way. So that would have been the outer covering for the table of the showbread. The same is true of the menorah, which also has porpoise skin on the outside. It says the golden altar in verse 11, that's the altar of incense. That is covered the same way as the previous two things. Then differently covered is the altar. If you'll recall, the altar is made of bronze and it sits outside of the tabernacle itself. And it is covered differently in that it is covered with purple cloth. Do they put porpoise skin on top of that? It doesn't look like it. No, it does. Then porpoise skin is put over the top of that. Okay. Eleazar, the oldest son of Aaron, as it said before, he supervises all of this activity. And he is responsible for four things: the oil for lighting the lamp, incense, the continual grain offering, and anointing oil. Then the warning in the last part of this section, where it is critical that no one looks at the holy objects, even for a moment, lest they die. Okay, so that's the Kohathites, the Gershonites, their duties. Verse 21. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take a census of the sons of Gershon, also by their fathers' households, by their families, from 30 years and upward to 50 years old, you shall number them. All who enter to perform the service, to do the work of the tent of meeting. This is the service of the families of the Gershonites in serving and in carrying. They shall carry the curtains of the tabernacle and the tent of meeting with its covering and the covering of porpoise skin that is on top of it, and the screen for the doorway of the tent of meeting and the hangings of the court, and the screen for the doorway of the gate of the court which is around the tabernacle and the altar, and their cords and all the equipment for their service, and all that is to be done they shall perform. All the service of the sons of the Gershonites in all their loads and in all their work shall be performed at the command of Aaron and his sons. And you shall assign to them as a duty all their loads. This is the service of the families of the sons of the Gershonites in the tent of meeting, and their duties shall be under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. So it gives their duties that are to carry all the fabric and the coverings of the tent, as well as the curtains that make up the surrounding of the courtyard. And as we'll see later, it appears that in this census, one of the things that they do is assign to each person their own responsibilities. So responsibilities are doled out at this time individually. It doesn't mention it here, but we learn later that the materials that the Gershonites are supposed to carry are carried by carts. They put them on carts and pull the carts. The same is true of the Merariites. They put their stuff on carts and then pull the carts. The Kohathites, who have the furniture, they don't put them on carts. They carry them on the poles. The Merarites, verse 29. As for the sons of Merari, you shall number them by their families, by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, you shall number them, everyone who enters the service, to do the work of the tent of meeting. Now this is the duty of their lords, for all loads, for all their service in the tent of meeting, the boards of the tabernacle and its bars and its pillars and its sockets and the pillars around the court and their sockets and their pegs and their cords with all their equipment and with all their service. And you shall assign each man by name the items. So there's the individual assignments he is to carry. This is the service of the families of the sons of Merari according to all their service in the tent of meeting under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. So they carry all that supporting structure. And those, when it talks about the sockets, those are at the base of the posts that make up the surrounding around the outside courtyard, the posts that are put at every interval with fabric hanging in between them. And those sockets, those are big. Those would be big, heavy objects to carry. So there's quite a bit of weight that they have to work with. Verse 34. So Moses and Aaron, the leaders of the congregation, numbered the sons of Kohathites by their families and by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service or work in the tent of meeting. And their numbered men by their families were 2,750. These are the numbered men of the Kohathite families, everyone who was serving in the tent of meeting, whom Moses and Aaron numbered according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. And the numbered men of the sons of Gershon by their families and by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service for work in the tent of meeting, and their numbered men by their families and by their fathers' households were 2,630. And these are the numbered men of the families of the sons of Gershon, everyone who was serving in the tent of meeting, whom Moses and Aaron numbered according to the commandment of the Lord. And the numbered men of the families of the sons of Merari by their families, by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service for work in the tent of meeting, and their numbered men by their families were 3,200. These are the numbered men of the families of the sons of Merari, whom Moses and Aaron numbered according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. All the numbered men of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron and the leaders of Israel numbered, by their families and by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, everyone who could enter to do the work of service and the work of carrying in the tent of meeting, and their numbered men were 8,580. According to the commandment of the Lord through Moses, they were numbered, everyone by his serving or carrying. Thus these were his numbered men, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So, two censuses of the Levites. The first census was to determine how many Levite men there were. And then they had to refer back to the census that was done in chapters 1 and 2 to figure out how many firstborn men there were in Israel. They compared those, and the firstborn that were in excess of the number of Levites had to be redeemed with 5 shekels each paid to the priests. The second census, then, is of all the Levites who are between this age range of 30 to 50, and they are the ones who do the work of transporting the tabernacle. And so those people are numbered, and their assignments are given out, each person receiving a specific assignment. So those are the two censuses that are described in these chapters. Now, in the time that remains, I want to go back to the incident that it referred to at the very beginning of our two chapters today, where it talks about the death of Nadab and Abihu. And this incident is described in Leviticus 10 in much greater detail than we have here. And that's, I want to look at that whole chapter, so we'll do it quickly. Now, as background, in Leviticus, there's very little action. It's mainly laws that are given to the people of Israel, additional laws to the ones that had already been given. And this all takes place in a period of time that's about 2 weeks long. So Leviticus fits into a period of time that's quite short. There isn't much time between the end of Exodus and the beginning of Numbers, and Leviticus squeezes in there. One of the things that occurs in Leviticus is the priests are consecrated. There is a ceremony in which the priest and the furniture in the tabernacle are all consecrated. And that activity occurs just before chapter 10. So they were at Mount Sinai when this is occurring. They still haven't left. And remember, it was at Mount Sinai that they had made a covenant with God. They had received the directions on how to build the tabernacle. They had built it. And then they had received further instructions with respect to offerings that they were to give and to the duties of the priests. And after they had received all of that additional information, the priests were consecrated. In this consecration, the priests were all washed. Then they put on their priestly garments. The furniture of the tabernacle was then anointed. Then the priests were anointed. And then Moses presented an ordination offering on behalf of the priests. Then the priests stayed in the tabernacle for 7 days. Says they didn't leave. On the 8th day, then, Aaron offered some sacrifices, first for themselves, that is, the priest being consecrated, then for the people. Then Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle. Then they came out and they blessed the people. And right after they blessed the people, the glory of God appeared to all of the people, and fire came out from before the Lord. So apparently it's coming out of the tabernacle. It comes out and it consumes the burnt offering and the portions of the fat on the altar. So fire comes out of the tabernacle and consumes the offering that's been placed on the altar outside, just outside the tabernacle. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Okay. So that is what has happened just before the events that we see in chapter 10. Let me read the first section of chapter 10. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it, and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'By those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored.'" Okay, so Nadab and Abihu, right after this has happened, and by this I mean fire has come out of the tabernacle and consumed the meat on the altar, they offer incense, but they offered strange fire. And the commentators all have different proposals as to what's going on here and what they did that caused them to be killed. Some say that it was the wrong incense. And I suspect the reason that they say that is in Exodus, as you will recall, it gives the formula for the incense that's supposed to be used in the tabernacle. And it says anything else, any other combination of ingredients, would be strange incense, and you're not to use it in the tabernacle. And it's the same word that's used there, strange. So some people think they use the wrong kind of incense. But it says strange fire here. So it seems to me more likely that it is not the incense that was wrong, but it's the fire that is wrong. The fire that was supposed to be used for the incense, I don't remember where it's supposed to come from. But my guess is that they used fire that was not from the place that it was supposed to be from. And I'll talk more about that later. So they burn strange fire, and now fire comes out just like the other one came out. It comes out and it burns up Nadab and Abihu. And as opposed to what happened when the fire came out and burnt up the offering and the people all shouted, we have this happening, the Lord speaking, and Aaron therefore kept silent. Okay, I'll read on. Moses called to Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Aaron's uncle, Uziel, and said to them, "Come forward, carry your relatives away from the front of the sanctuary to the outside of the camp." So they came forward and carried them, still in their tunics, to the outside of the camp, as Moses had said. Then Moses said to Aaron and to his sons Eleazar and Ithamar, "Do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes, so you may not die, and that he may not become wrathful against all the congregation. But your kinsmen, the whole house of Israel, shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about. You shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, lest you die. For the Lord's anointing oil is upon you. So they did according to the word of Moses. So they are forbidden to do anything with respect to these two dead priests. They can't touch them, they can't carry them out, and they can't mourn them in any way. It'll be other relatives that will do all of that. Verse 8, the Lord then spoke to Aaron, saying, do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you may not die. It is a perpetual statute, therefore, throughout your generations, and so as to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, and between the unclean and the clean, and so as to teach the sons of Israel all the statutes with which the Lord has spoken to them through Moses. This is a strange thing that comes in here. And this is one of those places where the organization matters. If the organization of numbers is random, you just have pieces put in here, then this could be just a piece stuck in here, and why it comes between the first part of chapter 10 and before the last part of chapter 10 does not matter. It's just stuck in here. I don't think that's the case. I think that we've got context working here, and this piece is put in here because it fits into the context. And my best guess is that it is related to the incident that had just occurred. The incident that had just occurred is Nadab and Abihu had done something that was wrong, or was unwise. It was unclean and it was profane. And what's being said here is that the priests are not to drink wine or strong drink when they come into the tent of meeting. And I think the reason is so that they will have good judgment, so that they can make the distinction between that which is holy and that which is profane, between that which is unclean and that which is clean. And also so that they can teach the sons of Israel to make those same distinctions. So I think that this prohibition is put here because Nadab and Abihu had imbibed, their judgment was harmed, and they did something that was foolish. Now we'll go on because I think the rest of the chapter has relevance to all of this that we need to take seriously. Then Moses spoke to Aaron and to his surviving sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. Take the grain offering that is left over from the Lord's offerings by fire and eat it unleavened beside the altar, for it is most holy. You shall eat it, moreover, in a holy place, because it is your due and your son's due out of the Lord's offerings by fire, for thus I have been commanded. The breast of the wave offering, however, and the thigh of the offering, you may eat in a clean place, you and your sons and your daughters with you, for they have been given as your due and your son's due out of the sacrifices of the peace offerings of the sons of Israel. The thigh offered by lifting up and the breast offered by waving, they shall bring along with the offerings by fire of the portions of fat to present as a wave offering before the Lord. So it shall be a thing perpetually due you and your sons with you, just as the Lord has commanded. So Moses is giving them instructions as to what is supposed to happen next. We're still in the process of consecrating the priests and the furniture in the tabernacle. And there's an offering that needs to be made of grain, and then there is there are wave offerings that are to be made, and the sons of Aaron are to eat that meat after it has been offered. Okay, the last section. But Moses searched carefully for the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it had been burned up. So he was angry with Aaron's surviving sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, saying, "Why did you not eat the sin offering at the holy place? For it is most holy, and he gave it to you to bear away the guilt of the congregation, to make atonement for them before the Lord. Behold, since its blood had not been brought inside into the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary, just as I commanded." But Aaron spoke to Moses, "Behold, this very day they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord. When things like these happened to me, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord?" And when Moses heard that, it seemed good in his sight. So Moses has just told them what they're supposed to do with these offerings, and they're supposed to do the wave offerings, and then they're supposed to eat the meat in a holy place. Moses has just told them all that. He comes back and looks, and nobody's eating. There aren't the plates with bones on them left over. And so he's thinking, what did they do? So he's upset that they did not follow the instructions that he had just given to them. But Aaron's response is, when things like these happened to me, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord? In other words, Aaron is thinking, you know, my two sons have just been devoured by a divine flame for disobedience. How then can we eat an offering, a sin offering, as a way of righteously disposing of this when that has just happened to my family? So Aaron judged that in these circumstances, it would be better for that offering to be burned rather than eaten. Okay. I said last week that I'm learning this stuff along the way. I don't know all the symbolism that's going on here. But as I understand it, there are two ways of disposing of an offering. If an offering is for relatively light sins, then those can be eaten by a priest as a way of accepting that sacrifice. That's a way of symbolizing accepting that sacrifice. And it does not contaminate the priest, which is interesting. But if it's grievous sin, a sacrifice can't be accepted that way. It has to be burned. And in this case, apparently, Aaron has judged that given the circumstances, it is not appropriate for the priests to eat this sin sacrifice. It needs to be burned. And apparently it's because he's thinking, we are not worthy. We have shown ourselves not worthy to eat it. If I can, I got too many pages of notes, the problem. Dalich quotes Baumgarten saying that they had not so strong and overpowering a holiness as was required for eating the sin, the general sin offering, given those circumstances. What's curious is Moses agrees with the reasoning. Moses approves what Aaron had done. Okay. In my mind, this is really significant. This is really interesting. And I am offering this to you as a possible understanding of what's going on. I will point out that I have found a number of commentators, a few commentators that are helpful in talking about the kinds of issues that I think need to be examined. But I couldn't find any commentator that talked about this particular thing. But let me explain what I think is happening here and why it's significant. We have two examples of innovation by priests that are going on here. The first one is the two sons of Aaron, and the second one is the younger sons of Aaron and Aaron himself, and apparently Aaron was the decision maker in this. In the first incident, Nadab and Abihu, they took strange fire when they should not have. My best guess is that they saw the fire coming out of the tabernacle to burn the offering, and they thought, we're going to capture some of that and use that fire. So an unusual circumstance had presented itself, and they wanted to say something, symbolically, they wanted to say something by taking the fire, whatever remained of the fire that came out of the tabernacle, and use that to burn incense. And God immediately then destroyed them. That whatever they were communicating by that change was an inappropriate thing to communicate. And my guess is that there's arrogance behind that. That they're thinking, we can do something great here. It's kind of like when the apostles were with Jesus at the Transfiguration, they say, let's build sukkahs to each of these guys. Wouldn't that be great? There's something, yes, apparently there is something that would be communicated by that is arrogant. The second innovation, it's interesting. You would think that just having had two sons zapped for doing something innovative in the religious ritual, that Aaron would decide, I'm doing this to the letter. But he doesn't take that perspective. The perspective he takes is, what needs to be communicated here? And so he does something that is not what was prescribed. He recognized the gravity of what had just happened. He thinks that the gravity of that needs to be captured. And as a result, it's inappropriate for the priest to eat that sin sacrifice. It needs to be burned. Now, I am not fluent in this language. I don't know exactly what's going on and what's being communicated. All I want to point out is we have two examples of innovation by priests. One is disapproved of. The second one is approved of. And the thing that I find fascinating about that is that, after the first innovation, which is disapproved of, they are told not to drink wine before coming into the holy place, into the tabernacle, because they have to have good judgment to be able to tell clean from unclean and profane from holy. So the priests, when they are performing the ritual, have to be actively engaged in what's going on, thinking about what's going on, understanding what is being communicated, and what would be communicated if there are any changes that are made, and make the judgment as to whether that would be a good thing or a bad thing. So it seems to me that we've got a situation that's very different than I had thought going into this. Because going into this, I would have guessed that the priests are just focused on doing exactly what they've been told to do. But now it looks to me like the priests are supposed to go into this engaged with what they are saying by the symbols that they are using. And what's critical is that they say the right things with the symbols that they have been given. And on rare occasions, and I'm sure it's rare occasions, it is right for them to deviate from the specific instructions that they've been given because the circumstance is such that something else needs to be communicated. The symbols have to be used in a different way. Okay. That's a different picture than I had had before, and that will come up as we go on for the next few weeks. But that's my best guess as to what's going on here, and obviously, you're the ones that have to decide whether I have put this together rightly or not. I am, I think, in a minority of one here, to the best of my knowledge. No one else actually talks about, it's not that people disagree with me, nobody talks about this particular issue, at least nobody that I have found up to now. Okay. We'll risk going over a little bit with just a couple of questions. And then
I'm going to try to go through these quickly. The Levites that were set apart, they were on the east. Did they keep that designation even up to when Jesus was in Jerusalem at that time?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, because I don't remember.
This is only as they're traveling on their way to the Promised Land. This is where they are supposed to camp.
So this is part of the tabernacle experience.
Yes,
basically.
Yes.
Okay.
And they have a certain order in which they camp. They also have a certain order in which they march. And those are related.
And what's coming to my mind with the, as you say, innovation with the sons and then with Aaron himself. Mm-hmm. To me, it seems like almost like a beginning of it's the intent, not the law itself. Because, I mean, I'm thinking back when Jesus and the disciples were going through the field and they picked the corn. Mm-hmm. I think... and then you see in some other examples that God is not saying, is saying more, it's your heart and the intent that's more important than the actual letter of the law. Mm-hmm. And for instance, David too, because mm-hmm. God said he's a man after my own heart, but right. He definitely was not sinless.
Right.
And then my last one is...
Let me comment on that one before you go. I'm not sure that it's intent. I think it's on what is communicated. If someone is well-intended but communicates the wrong thing, I think that's a problem.
Okay, maybe intent is not the best word. Basically, what I'm trying to portray is like what their heart is toward God. And
right. At this point, my understanding would be That is critical with respect to the destiny of the person, the eternal destiny of the person, and their relationship with God. But if we're talking about the religious ritual, what's critical is that the right thing be communicated. So my best guess is that someone with a good intention who communicates the wrong thing, that's a problem.
Okay, then can you explain a little more about what Aaron was doing? Because I see kind of more of that from him. It's like he sees his situation and says, you know, something needs to be done. Something needs to be communicated.
Right. I think that's the situation. He says, he's thinking, in given this particular set of circumstances, communicating the right thing requires a different use of the symbols.
Okay. Well,
now here's where my lack of fluency in this language is a problem, because I'm not sure exactly what's being communicated and how it's happening. But I think what's being communicated, my best guess is that there is something about what has just happened that suggests that the priests are not really worthy to be ingesters of this sin sacrifice, and that's what he wants to communicate.
Okay, I'm going to think about this some more, because I kind of see that as intent. But anyway, thank you. And then just one quick question. I may have to email you about this. The porpoise skin, did they dye it to make it red?
Mm-hmm. Okay. They did, yeah. Okay, I better let you go. Thanks.